It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in New York. In addition to being head of research at Firebird Management, Steve Gorelick is the fund manager of Firebird US Value Fund, as well as portfolio manager of Firebird's Eastern Europe and Russia funds. He joined Firebird in 2005 from Columbia Business School while completing education from a highly selective value investing program. Prior to business school, Steve was an operational strategy consultant at Deloitte, working with companies in various industries, including banking, healthcare, and retail. I want to draw your attention to Steve's past presentations at our online conferences, as well as his wonderful article, Why We Invest in Eastern Europe. All of those are available on the MOI Global website. And now, on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, Steve. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John, for the kind introduction. And it is my pleasure to again present for the MOI Global community. Before I start, let me ask you a question. What type of companies do you think make the best investments?
So I'll be very brief, Steve, because I want you to have the floor. As everyone knows here, there are numerous flavors of value investing. I personally put great emphasis on valuation, so a discount to intrinsic value. Obviously, if that's there, then I like companies that can actually compound capital and value for a long time. So hopefully they have reinvestment opportunities and a long runway to grow the business. And now back to you.
Right, thank you. And I think we're all at this point looking for, as value investors, we're looking for similar type of companies. And if we can find these cheap compounders, high quality companies able to profitably reinvest capital in their core business, that is really the holy grail of our investments. Since I'm not alone in looking for these type of investments, finding high quality businesses that are still cheap became almost as difficult as encountering a unicorn, a non-tech kind. There is, however, one area where I believe investors can still find high quality growing companies trading in single digit PE multiples, and that area is Eastern European banks. Today's presentation is going to be about one of them. We at Firebird Management have been investing in Eastern Europe for what will be 25 years next March. One of the favorite parts of my job is to hear Harvey and Ian, firm's founders, tell stories about their investment environment in Russia in mid-90s, including how they couldn't find a decent place to eat in Moscow, but were acquiring vouchers, which were exchanged later for shares of various companies, some of which is still in our portfolio today. Hearing these stories helps appreciate how much investment environment has changed for the better over these years. Even in my 12 years with the company, I went from deciphering 130-page long Russian accounting standard reporting to reading management discussion portion of IFRS financial statements referring to familiar concepts such as return on invested capital, operating margins, and others. One thing I will point out from this slide is that 40% of the capital we manage is our own, which acts like permanent capital and allows us to invest a portion of the portfolio in high quality but less liquid companies in smaller countries. As John mentioned in the introduction, I wrote an article a few months ago for Manual of Ideas about why we invest in Eastern Europe. Today's presentation will take you further down the rabbit hole and get into specifics of why we invest in Eastern European banks. First, we find that investing in banks is the best way to get exposure to the whole economy. A typical bank will lend to retail businesses in the form of working capital financing, manufacturing and extractive industries in the form of capital investment loans, and retail clients through consumer loans, credit cards, and mortgages. Second, and related, is the implied sustainable growth. Many of the economies in Eastern Europe are structurally underbanked, with banking assets to GDP at 60% or even lower than Western European levels. Over time, the gap between East and West has been narrowing through the development and adoptions of products such as mortgages, SME loans, and others that have been familiar to us in the West for a long time. Underlying economies are growing in nominal terms at high single-digit rates. The narrowing of the banking assets gap creates a multiple effect and increases sustainable growth rate to 10 to 20% depending on the country. Third is the management. Banks can be highly profitable, but also must be run well due to inherent leverage. That is why banks, especially the surviving ones, attract some of the best management in the country. Bank of Georgia, which has been in our portfolio for over 10 years, became the go-to institutions for the expats returning to Georgia following the Rose Revolution in 2003. And to this day, remains one of the best-run companies in the region. In Russia, they found the most competent technocrat in the government, German Grief, to run the systemic institution of Sberbank. The company that holds 45% of domestic deposits has to be run well or could turn into political stability risk for the government. Fourth reason is the simple business models. Eastern European banks make money the old-fashioned way, through lending at much higher interest rates than what they offer in deposits. They do not need to reserve to derivative trading, holding higher-risk paper in order to sustain double-digit ROEs. It is not uncommon to see a net interest margin spread of 4 to 5% for a bank that is operating in local currency. For example, Šiaulių Bankas in Lithuania made 80% of their operating revenue from interest. Sberbank in Russia made 70% of its revenue from interest income, but JP Morgan in the United States only makes 48%. Fifth is a competitive landscape. Prior to 2008, investing in Eastern European banks was an almost certain source of profitable growth for Western European institutions. As a result of acquisitions, Scandinavian, Italian, Austrian banks currently control as much as 90% market share in Czech Republic, the Baltic states, and elsewhere in the region. The global financial crisis of 2008 exposed issues in the domestic balance sheets of the parent banks, which forced them to repatriate cash and leave their Eastern European subsidiaries to fend for themselves. Locally owned SME lenders like Banca Transilvania in Romania, Šiaulių Bankas in Lithuania, used this opportunity to grow into the void opened up by foreign banks withdrawing from the market. Since 2015, Western European institutions have started cautiously growing their books again in Eastern Europe, but loan approval powers remain at the head offices in Stockholm or Vienna, keeping the banks at a disadvantage to local players who can provide faster decisions and better customer service. With that said, investing in banks is not for the faint of heart. Due to the built-in leverage, it is especially important to select banks with sustainable competitive advantages and competent management teams. Over the years, we identified a few areas of focus that helps us make better selections. One is economic environment. The underlying economy should be growing in nominal USD terms in order for dollar-based investors to generate positive returns. While most analysts concentrate on real GDP growth when they describe an economic environment, it's the nominal USD or euro number that accurately reflects what is happening in the underlying economy and considers currency movements. Then there's asset quality. While it's very difficult to know what exactly is on the bank's balance sheets, there are a few pieces of information that can help an investor get comfortable with the quality of assets. One is cash interest received versus accrued. IFRS financial statements provide disclosure on cash interest collected, which can be compared to cash interest accrued on the income statement. Accruals that are much higher than interest collected are usually a sign of poor asset quality that will become a problem sooner or later. Then there's NPL coverage. Most banks will provide detail on non-performing loan coverage with and without collateral. Due to the distressed nature of asset sales, we find that collateral gets realized at only 20 to 40% of its face value, and therefore reported coverages should be adjusted accordingly. There's also non-loan assets. Most banks will have some percentage of their balance sheets in non-loan assets. It is important to understand what is included in this pool of assets and whether you're buying a bank holding government securities or some lower grade paper. The other area to look at is funding sources. Banks with loan-to-deposit ratios of over 100% are vulnerable to external shocks, especially if the funding is coming from international capital markets. In 2018, investors in Turkish banks learned the hard way that reliance on foreign funding could be a problem, especially in a rising rate environment. When all right pieces fall into place, high profitability and growth combine to compound book value at 20 to 30% per annum. The banks on this list have been in our portfolio for years, and in some cases over a decade. Over this time, they've generated high IRRs, yet remain reasonably priced thanks to earnings and book value compounding. However, when either the economic environment, asset quality, or funding sources are suspect, these investments often become value traps or worse. That is why it is important to buy the best banks available rather than the cheapest. We couldn't stress it more, but a bit more about buying the best. We've learned the hard way that buying a cheap-looking bank simply because it trades at a discount to a better-run peer is one of the surest way of getting into a value trap or value-destructive situation. The best does not mean the biggest and is not a permanent state, since good management can transform a financial institution. Buying banks is not a buy-and-forget type of proposition, but when it works, it really works. Here's a chart of Sberbank, which we believe to be the best bank in Russia, compared to VTB, which is another state-owned institution that does not have the same domestic deposit franchise or quality of management as Sber. It always traded a discount to book value to Sber, but as you can see, one is very lucrative investment, while other one lost value over the last few years. This is a chart from Romania, where Banca Transilvania, locally owned SME lender, has eaten the lunch of foreign-owned competitors such as BRD, that is majority owned by Societatea Generală, and BCR, which is owned by Erste. For years, these banks largely stayed out of the market while they dealt with historical issues on their balance sheet and lack of funding from corporate parents. Banca Transilvania, as a local lender used to lending in local currency, went from strength to strength, and has now become the largest bank in the country. In Kazakhstan, these two banks operated a virtual duopoly since the financial crisis. Halyk Bank is Kazakh's version of Sberbank, has a domestic deposit franchise, and is well run. KKB was the high-flying bank prior to the crisis, but went through the series of restructurings and eventually was bought with government's urging and support by Halyk, which bought control for just one tenge. Now that you're a bit more comfortable with the idea of investing in Eastern European banks, the specific institution I would like to talk to you about today is Šiaulių Bankas, which is the fourth largest bank in Lithuania with about 8% market share. Before I do that, a few words about the country of operations. Lithuania is a former Soviet republic of 2.8 million people. It has been a member of EU and NATO since 2004 and Euro since 2015. Lithuanian GDP per capita is roughly $16,500, which is up four times since 2000, but is still less than half of European Union levels. 2008 was the moment of truth for Lithuania as well as two northern neighbors, Latvia and Estonia. All three countries had currencies pegged to the euro and were running structural double-digit current account imbalances financed by foreign flows channeled through foreign control banking institutions. When the great financial crisis came, foreign funding largely evaporated, and these economies were faced with a choice of painful restructuring or currency devaluation. Despite the urgings of experts, they chose to maintain the currency peg in order to stay on course of joining the euro. We saw wages falling by 10%, unemployment spiking to 15%, and GDP declining by 14% between 2007 and 2009. But at the end, an economy that weaned itself off dependence on foreign funding and restored its competitiveness. Since the beginning of 2010, GDP started expanding again. An economy has been growing at a pace of 2 to 3% above Western European levels. While the growth is still below pre-2008 levels, it is much more sustainable, with current account deficits near zero and loan-to-resident deposit ratio indicating that funding is coming from domestic sources. Lithuania today is a vibrant, diversified economy with contributions from agriculture, service, and other sectors. Thanks to its well-educated workforce, it has become one of the go-to places for back-office relocations for companies like Western Union Barclays, and others. More recently, Lithuania started making headways as a startup destination, with 8 out of 50 fastest-growing companies in Eastern Europe, as recognized in the annual Deloitte study. I've already mentioned a couple of times that banking system in the Baltics are dominated by Scandinavian banks. In the case of Lithuania, the top three banks, representing 81% of the banking system, are all foreign. SEB, Swedbank, and Luminor, which is a merger of local branches of Norwegian DNB Nord and Danish Nordea, that was recently bought by Blackstone. In total, foreign banks control over 90% of Lithuanian banking system. Despite years of convergence, Lithuania remains structurally underbanked, with banking assets to GDP of around 58% versus 140% or more in places like Spain, France, and United Kingdom. Loan growth for the system was negative between 2009 and 2015, as foreign-owned banks were restricting new loans issuances due to troubles at home. But it has turned positive since 2015, and has been going up by 5 to 10% per annum ever since. Šiaulių Bankas is the only significant bank in Lithuania that is not foreign owned. Aside from 26% ownership by EBRD, it is owned mostly by local high net worth individuals, investment firms, pension funds, and retail investors. Free float is around 50%. Firebird Management has been a shareholder since 2015, and we own about 3% of this bank. The bank transformed itself from a small regional SME-focused lender into a nationwide institution when it bought Ūkio Bankas and later Finasta, two other small Lithuanian banks. New management team came in 2011 and have been running it ever since. The acquisition of Ūkio and Finasta proved transformative for the fortunes of the bank, since it allowed them to move more than double the balance sheet and gain scale in order to provide services to clients nationwide. Despite bigger size, they've continued to focus on SME and retail clients by providing better service than foreign-owned institutions. Foreign banks took loan approval decisions back to headquarters in Stockholm or Copenhagen, which extended the time of approval to up to a month. By comparison, Šiaulių Bankas makes decision locally in Lithuania and is able to grant this decision in a week or two. Borrowers also feel more comfortable working with a bank that can understand and address their concerns without having to go back for approvals to the higher-ups in other countries. Šiaulių Bankas was the only sizable bank in Lithuania growing its loan book between 2012 and 2015, when the system-wide loans were negative. Since 2015, the growth accelerated together with the rest of Lithuanian economy and has been in 12 to 18% range ever since. In the process, bank reduced costs dramatically and grew fee income thanks to increasing revenues from settlement transactions and cash operations. All these improvements led to significant improvement in ROE from low single digits to high teens in the last few years. We believe that Šiaulių Bankas is the best bank in Lithuania. As you can see, Šiaulių Bankas checks off all the items on our bank checklist presented earlier. We have an environment of strong nominal GDP growth in USD terms, domestic deposit franchise, high quality of assets, and improving efficiency. We have a bank that is generating sustainable ROE of 15% despite being overcapitalized, and is growing loan book by about 10% per annum. Since we can buy this bank today for roughly 1x book value, ROE plus loan growth would give us an annual compounded return of around 24-25%. Without any change in multiple. However, we believe that over time, the market will start paying attention to the excess returns available and will re-rate Šiaulių Bankas higher. Greenwald and Value Investing book gave us a formula on how to value growing institutions, such as this one, that suggests that investors with assumed 12% cost of equity should be willing to pay up to 1.4 times book value for a bank generating these types of profits and growth. If we do get the re-rating suggested by this formula, then the expected IRR of this position increases to over 35%. In the past, Šiaulių Bankas has traded in a range of anywhere between 0.6 to 1.25 book value where it traded earlier this year. So why is it cheap? We believe that there are a few reasons that have little to do with underlying business fundamentals. First is the perceived stock overhang from EBRD and local individual institutions that used to be part of shareholders' agreement. EBRD has been a shareholder since 2005 and typically has 4 to 7 year holding period for its equity investments. They've recently converted debt, increasing their stake in the company from 18 to 26%. Rumors surrounding EBRD ownership have been circling the bank for at least 2 years, and we are now seemingly closer to some kind of resolution after this loan conversion. In the past, when EBRD chose to exit their minority stakes through the market, they were offered at a steep discount to prevailing market prices. Market participants are understandably holding onto the dry powder, hoping to capitalize on this opportunity if it comes up. The other parties to the shareholders' agreement is a group of Lithuanian individuals and businesses that have acquired stakes in this bank, many of them right around financial crisis. Now that shareholder agreement has been dissolved, it leaves them open to selling their stakes in the company at any time without coordinating with other parties. Since shareholders include individuals who are getting up there in age and companies where Šiaulių Bankas is a non-core asset, market is concerned about overhang. The shares traded down by about 18% since dissolution of the shareholder agreement in August, despite the bank reporting record Q3 earnings. Then there's also the trading level of overall Baltic market. The whole market is cheap, trading at 10 PE and 5% dividend yield. Since 2007 crisis, liquidity has dried up and trading volumes fell by a factor of 10. We're now seeing average daily trading volume of 2 to 3 million euros per day across all three countries. Šiaulių Bankas is one of the blue chips, trading whopping 200,000 euros per day. This level of trading is too small for many foreign investors and leaves the market in the hands of retail investors and local pension funds, which are reluctant to put money to work in the equity markets. There's also recent concerns about the Baltic banking system. Thanks to the scandals surrounding ABLV in Latvia, which got its license taken away for acting as a conduit for North Korean money, and venerable Danske Bank managing to channel 200 billion euros of Russian money through its Estonian branch. It is important to note that non-resident participation in the Lithuanian banking system is minimal, with less than 5% of deposits coming from non-resident sources, compared to 11% in Estonia and 40% in Latvia. So what can be the catalyst for revaluation? First, there's just compounding. As I mentioned earlier, investors in Šiaulių Bankas should be able to make around 25% per annum if the bank is able to maintain current ROE and pace of growth. We have been investors since 2015 and have compounded our investment by around 30% per annum. Price to book multiple did go up from around 0.7 to 1 times, but most of the move was thanks to earnings growth. Then there are higher dividends. After dissolution of the shareholders' agreement, bank declared new dividend policy committing to pay out at least 25% of IFRS net income and dividends starting next year. The bank is well capitalized and should be able to pay even higher number, but even at 25%, dividend yield will go up from below 1% to over 3%, and it will be much closer to the level typical of the other Baltic stocks. Last but not least is the potential for M&A. Given the large ownership by EBRD, it is possible that the bank may attract interest from strategic buyers looking to enter Lithuania. There was a transaction earlier this year where Blackstone bought control of Pan-Baltic Luminor, paying 1x book value, for a bank with ROE well below Šiaulių Bankas levels. LHV, a bank in Estonia which has similar ROE levels as Šiaulių Bankas, is trading at around 1.7 book value on Estonian Stock Exchange. Polish banks, for whom Šiaulių Bankas would be very natural bite-sized acquisition, are all trading at much higher PE levels despite lower ROEs than our bank. In closing, we believe that many Eastern European banks represent attractive investment opportunities. This is the one of few places where we know where you can buy high-quality market-leading growing institutions at single-digit PEs and dividend yields of 5% plus. We believe investing in banks is hard, but could be extremely lucrative, especially if you can find one with differentiated market position and high quality management team. We believe one of these banks is Šiaulių Bankas in Lithuania, and I would welcome any questions or comments on this topic. Thank you so much.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for both talking a little bit about the merits of investing in banks in Eastern Europe and also for the specific investment case here. Perhaps a question on or a clarification, the 25 to 35% IRR to long-term holders that you expect here. Is it possible to disaggregate that into components?
Sure. So going back to slide 19, when we're predicting 25 to 35% IRR, we're assuming 15% sustainable ROE, which is what the bank is talking about. Their recent ROE has been higher, closer to 19-20%, but we think 15% is sustainable. And the level of growth of 10% per annum of loan growth, which is where the bank has, once again, recent growth has been higher, 12 to 18%, but we think it can do 10% per annum from here for the next 3 to 5 years. So together, given that the bank is trading at 1x book, these two numbers get you about 25% IRR, assuming the multiple does not change. We do think that this company is too cheap at 1x book. The formula that we have on the slide is, as I mentioned earlier, from the Value Investing book by Bruce Greenwald, where he gives a handy way to estimate what is the value for growing institutions given different growth levels. I'm actually assuming growth of only 5% for the purposes of this formula. And assuming the bank can sustain 15% ROE, normalized growth of 5%, and cost of equity of 12%, this bank should be trading closer to 1.4 times book instead of one. So if we get to that multiple, then the IRR would go up to 35, 36%.
Could you shed more light on management incentives, please?
That's a great question. I think management is incentivized in terms of ROE, from what I believe, and also growth. I don't have enough information to say whether they're shareholders or what portion of their ownership or their compensation is tied to the share price, but I will follow up on that.
Steve, in terms of the geopolitical situation, is that something that figures into the investment case at all? How do you think about any risks there?
So in terms of the domestic politics, we think Lithuania is one of the countries in the region that we consider to be post-political. When you have changes in the parliament, it goes really from center-left to center-right or back, and the general policy of the government does not change. There's always, when you talk about Eastern Europe, there's always a question of, what is the relationship with Russia? Is there potential for Russian meddling in this country? Frankly, there is, if Russia is going to become more aggressive in any direction, there's lower hanging fruit than going after a member of EU and NATO. But also we think that from a point of view of Russia, it's not in their interest right now to be expanding geographically or trying to create similar problems as they did in Ukraine back in 2014. So that is something that market has a concern about in case about any country in Eastern Europe or any company you would invest in Eastern Europe. But we do think that in small open economies like Lithuania, that is where with stable politics, these concerns are overplayed.
In terms of the long-term growth outlook for the bank, what is the most likely drivers there? Is it market share gains? Is it perhaps expansion in the Baltics? What do you see as kind of the path for this bank becoming meaningfully larger over the next decade?
We think it's market share gains. It's possible that the bank will look outside of Lithuania to play to the other Baltic countries, but we don't think it has any kind of advantage there. So we would be very careful looking at if the bank does announce that they decide to go in Latvia, for example. There is a couple of cases of institutions from other countries like Citadele, which has a similar position in Latvia, going to Lithuania and Estonia, and LHV from Estonia, kind of thinking about operating in other countries. But usually those lenders end up in a similar position as other foreign-owned institutions, meaning that the decision power is offshore, service quality is not any better, and they are disadvantaged because of the smaller balance sheet compared to these bigger guys. So, but meanwhile, in terms of growth, when you're looking at a country like Lithuania, you have a GDP growth right now around 4% in real terms. You have a inflation of around 3-4%. Together, you're getting a nominal GDP growth of 8 or 9% as it has been earlier this year. And then there's a multiple effect of the banking assets to GDP gap shrinking compared to Western Europe. So as a result of that, we think that the loan growth should be slightly higher than the GDP growth. And also, Šiaulių Bankas is gaining share on their foreign competitors. Luminor, which is a company that was merged earlier, it was a merger of two Scandinavian-owned banks earlier, has been losing clients to Šiaulių Bankas because of they're going through a transition and different growing pains that come with this merger. So right now, that's been an area of opportunity for Šiaulių Bankas. And in general, they're able to provide loan decision in 1 to 2 weeks versus 3 to 4 weeks. And that's a big difference. So they have been gaining share at the expense of foreign institutions, and we believe that they can continue to gain share. One example I can give is from Romania, where you and this is a company I mentioned earlier in the presentation, and it's also in our portfolio, Banca Transilvania, which has been growing at the just domestically and at the expense of foreign-owned institutions, and went from, I believe, fourth or fifth biggest lender back in 2009, 2010, to now being the biggest institution in the country by focusing on the SME clients.
Steve, thank you so much for articulating the thesis and answering my questions. I would just like to encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you directly with their own thoughts and questions. And your contact information is shown here on the screen.
John, thank you so much.
Very much appreciated. Goodbye for now.